We laughed among ourselves at the idea of warm jail food. It was a contradiction in terms. Eventually, the authorities supplied the detainees with what they called an improved diet. Africans received bread, while Indians and coloreds received the same food provided to white prisoners. I enjoyed one extraordinary privilege during our detention, weekend trips to Johannesburg. These were not a vacation from prison, but a busman's holiday. Shortly before the state of emergency, Oliver left South Africa on the instructions of the ANC. We had long suspected a clampdown was coming, and the Congress decided that certain members needed to leave the country to strengthen the organization abroad in anticipation of the time it would be banned entirely. Oliver's departure was one of the most well-planned and fortunate actions ever taken by the movement. At the time, we hardly suspected how absolutely vital the external wing would become. With his wisdom and calmness, his patience and organizational skills, his ability to lead and inspire without stepping on toes, Oliver was the perfect choice for this assignment. Before leaving, Oliver had retained a mutual friend of ours, Jaime Davidoff, a local attorney, to close up our office and wind up our practice. Davidoff made a special request to Colonel Prinsloo to permit me to come to Johannesburg on weekends to help him put things in order. In a fit of generosity, Colonel Prinsloo agreed, allowing me to be driven to Johannesburg on Friday afternoons to work in the office all weekend and then be driven back to the trial on Monday morning. Sergeant Kruger and I would leave after court adjourned at 1 o'clock on Friday, and after arriving at my office, I would work with Davidoff and our accountant, Nathan Marcus. I would spend the nights in Marshall Square Prison and the days at the office. Sergeant Kruger was a tall and imposing fellow who treated us with fairness. On the way from Pretoria to Johannesburg, he would often stop the car and leave me inside while he went into a shop to buy biltong, oranges, and chocolate for both of us. I thought about jumping out of the car, especially on Fridays, when the sidewalks and streets were busy and one could get lost in a crowd. While at the office, I could walk downstairs to the ground floor cafe to buy incidentals, and he turned his head aside on one or two occasions when Winnie came to visit me. We had a kind of gentleman's code between us. I would not escape and thereby get him into trouble, while he permitted me a degree of freedom. Chapter 36. On April 25th, the day before the trial was to resume, Izzy Maisels called us together to discuss the grave effect the state of emergency was having on the conduct of the trial. Because of the emergency regulations, consultations between the accused and our lawyers had become virtually impossible. Our lawyers, who were based in Johannesburg, had trouble seeing us in prison and were unable to prepare our case. They would often drive up and be informed that we were not available. Even when we were able to see them, consultations were harassed and cut short. More important, Maisels explained that under the emergency regulations, those already in detention would be exposing themselves to further detention merely by testifying, for they would inevitably make statements regarded as subversive, thereby subjecting themselves to greater penalties. Defense witnesses who were not imprisoned now risked detainment if they testified. The defense team proposed that they withdraw from the case in protest. Maisels explained the serious implications of such a withdrawal and the consequences of our conducting our own defense in a capital case. Under the hostile atmosphere at the time, he said, the judges might see fit to give us longer terms of imprisonment. We discussed the proposal among ourselves, and each of the 29 accused, we were now minus Wilton Mwege, was able to express his opinion. The resolution was unanimously endorsed, and it was agreed that Duma Nokwe and I would help in preparing the case in the absence of our lawyers. I was in favor of this dramatic gesture, for it highlighted the iniquities of the state of emergency. On April 26th, Duma Nokwe, the first African advocate in the Transvaal, rose in court and made the sensational announcement that the accused were instructing defense counsel to withdraw from the case. Maisels then said simply, "We have no further mandate, and we will consequently not trouble your lordships any further." After which, the defense team silently filed out of the synagogue. This shocked the three-judge panel, who warned us in direst terms about the dangers of conducting our own defense. But we were angry and eager to take on the state. For the next 5 months, until the virtual end of the emergency, we conducted our own defense. Our strategy was simple and defensive in nature, to drag out the case until the state of emergency was lifted and our lawyers could return. The case had gone on so long already that it did not seem to matter if we stretched it out even further. In practice, this strategy became rather comical. Under the law, each one of us was now entitled to conduct his own defense and was able to call as a witness each of the other accused, and each of the accused was entitled to cross-examine each witness. We were arranged in alphabetical order according to the docket, and accused number one was Farid Adams of the Transvaal Indian Youth Congress. Farid would open his case by calling accused number two, Helen Joseph, as his first witness. After being examined by Farid, Helen would then be cross-examined by the 27 other co-accused. She would then be cross-examined by the Crown and re-examined by accused number one. Adams would then proceed to call accused number three, and so on, and the whole procedure would duplicate itself until every accused was called in this fashion. At that rate, we would be at trial until the millennium. It is never easy to prepare a case from prison, and in this instance we were hampered by the customary apartheid barriers. All of the accused needed to be able to meet together, but prison regulations prohibited meetings between male and female prisoners, and between black and white. So we were not permitted to consult with Helen Joseph, Leon Levy, Lillian Ngoyi, and Bertha Mashaba. Helen, as the first witness to be called, needed to prepare her evidence in the presence of Duma, myself, and Farid Adams, who would be examining her. After protracted negotiations with the prison authorities, we were permitted to have consultations under very strict conditions. Helen Joseph, Lillian, Leon, and Bertha were to be brought from their various prisons and sections, separated by race and gender, to the African Men's Prison. The first stipulation was that there could be no physical contact between white and black prisoners and between male and female prisoners. The authorities erected an iron grill to separate Helen and Leon, as whites, from us, and a second partition to separate them from Lillian, who was also participating in the preparations. Even a master architect would have had trouble designing such a structure. In prison, we were separated from each other by this elaborate metal contraption, while in court we all mingled freely. We first needed to coach Farid in the art of courtroom etiquette and rehearse Helen's testimony. To help Helen, I was playing the role that Farid would play in court. I assumed the proper courtroom manner and began the examination. "Name?" I said. "Helen Joseph," she replied. "Age?" Silence. I repeated, "Age." Helen pursed her lips and waited. Then, after some moments, she scowled at me and said sharply, "What has my age to do with this case, Nelson?" Helen was as charming as she was courageous, but she also had an imperious side. She was a woman of a certain age and sensitive about it. I explained that it was customary to note down the witness's particulars, such as name, age, address, and place of birth. A witness's age helps the court to weigh her testimony and influences sentencing. I continued. "Age?" Helen stiffened. "Nelson," she said, "I will cross that bridge when I come to it in court, but not until then. Let us move on." I then asked her a series of questions that she might expect from the Crown in a manner perhaps too realistic for her, because at one point Helen turned to me and said, "Are you Mandela or are you the prosecutor?" There were other light moments, some of which were quite encouraging. I was permitted to visit Helen Joseph on weekends and bring her records of the proceedings. On these occasions, I met other women detainees and consulted with them as possible witnesses. I was always very cordial with the white wardresses, and I noticed that my visits caused considerable interest. The wardresses had never known there was even such a species as an African lawyer or doctor, and regarded me as an exotic creature. But as I became more familiar, they became more friendly and at ease, and I joked with them that I would handle any of their legal problems. Seeing prominent and educated white women discussing serious matters with a black man on the basis of perfect equality could only lead to the weakening of the wardress's apartheid assumptions. Once, during a long interview with Helen, I turned to the wardress who was required to sit in on our conversation and said, "I'm sorry to bore you with this endless consultation." "No," she said, "you are not boring me at all. I am enjoying it." I could see she was following our conversation, and once or twice she even offered small suggestions. I saw this as one of the side benefits of the trial. Most of these wardresses had no idea why we were in prison, and gradually began to discover what we were fighting for and why we were willing to risk jail in the first place. This is precisely why the National Party was violently opposed to all forms of integration. Only a white electorate, indoctrinated with the idea of the black threat, ignorant of African ideas and policies, could support the monstrous racist philosophy of the National Party. Familiarity, in this case, would not breed contempt, but understanding, and even, eventually, harmony. The light moments in prison could not make up for the low ones. Winnie was allowed to visit on a number of occasions while I was in Pretoria, and each time she brought Zinani, who was then beginning to walk and talk. I would hold her and kiss her if the guards permitted me, and toward the end of the interview, hand her back to Winnie. As Winnie was saying goodbye, and the guards were ushering them out, Zini would often motion for me to come with them, and I could see on her small, puzzled face that she did not understand why I could not. In court, Fareed Adams deftly led Helen through her evidence in chief. He argued frequently and fairly competently with the judges. We were now energized. No longer was anyone doing crossword puzzles to pass the time. As the accused took turns cross-examining the witnesses, the Crown and the prosecution began to get a sense for the first time of the true caliber of the men and women on trial. According to South African law, since we were in the Supreme Court, Duma, as an advocate, was the only one permitted to address the judges directly. I, as an attorney, could instruct him, but I was not technically permitted to address the court, and neither were any of the other defendants. We dismissed our advocates under the correct assumption that an accused, in the absence of representation, would be permitted to address the court. I addressed the court, and Judge Rumpf, trying to frustrate us, interrupted me. "You appreciate the fact, Mr. Mandela," he said, "that Mr. Nokwe, as an advocate, is the only lawyer who is permitted to address the court." To which I replied, "Very well, my lord, I believe we are all prepared to abide by that as long as you are prepared to pay Mr. Nokwe his fees." From then on, no one objected to any of the accused addressing the court. While Fareed was questioning Helen and the subsequent witnesses, Duma and I sat on either side of him, supplying him with questions, helping him to deal with legal issues as they arose. In general, he did not need much prompting. But one day, when we were under constant pressure, we were whispering suggestions to him every few seconds. Fareed seemed weary, and Duma and I were running out of material. Then, without consulting us, Fareed suddenly asked the judges for a postponement, saying he was fatigued. The judges refused his application, saying it was not sufficient reason for a postponement, and reiterating the warning they gave us the day our lawyers withdrew. That afternoon, there was no singing as we returned to prison, and everyone sat with sullen faces. A crisis was brewing among the accused. Upon our arrival in prison, a handful of the accused demanded a meeting. I called all the men together, and J. Nkampene, a businessman from Port Elizabeth who had helped out the families of defiers during the Defiance campaign, led what turned out to be an attack. "Madiba," he said, using my clan name as a sign of respect, I want you to tell us why you drove away our lawyers. I reminded him that the lawyers were not released by any one individual. Their withdrawal had been approved by all, including himself. But what did we know about court procedure, Madiba? He said. We relied on you lawyers. A substantial number of men shared Nkampene's misgivings. I warned them against the dangers of being disheartened and insisted we were doing quite well. I said that today was a minor setback and that we would face worse difficulties. Our case was far more than a trial of legal issues between the Crown and a group of people charged with breaking the law. It was a trial of strength, a test of the power of a moral idea versus an immoral one. And I said we needed to worry about more than just the legal technique of our advocates. The protest abated. After Helen Joseph had been cross-examined and re-examined, accused number three, Ahmed Kathrada, opened his case. It was during the testimony of Kathy's second witness, accused number four, Stanley Lolan, a member of the executive of the Colored People's Congress, that Prime Minister Fervord announced that the state of emergency would soon be lifted. The emergency had never been intended to be permanent, and the government believed that it had successfully stifled the liberation struggle. At this point, our defense lawyers returned, to the general relief of all of us, though we remained in prison for another few weeks. We had been kept in detention and had functioned without our lawyers for more than 5 months. My own testimony began on August 3rd. I felt well prepared through my preparation of the others. After 3 years of silence, banning, and internal exile, I looked forward to the chance to speak out before the people attempting to judge me. During my evidence in chief, I preached moderation and reaffirmed the ANC's commitment to non-violent struggle. In answer to a question as to whether democracy could be achieved through gradual reforms, I suggested it could. We demand universal adult franchise, and we are prepared to exert economic pressure to attain our demands. We will launch defiance campaigns, stay-at-homes, either singly or together, until the government should say, "Gentlemen, we cannot have this state of affairs, laws being defied, and this whole situation created by stay-at-homes. Let's talk." In my own view, I would say, "Yes, let us talk." And the government would say, "We think that the Europeans at present are not ready for a type of government where they might be dominated by non-Europeans. We think we should give you 60 seats. The African population to elect 60 Africans to represent them in Parliament. We will leave the matter over for 5 years, and we will review it at the end of 5 years. In my view, that would be a victory, my lords. We would have taken a significant step toward the attainment of universal adult suffrage for Africans, and we would then, for the 5 years, say, we will suspend civil disobedience." The state was determined to prove that I was a dangerous, violence-spouting communist. While I was not a communist or a member of the party, I did not want to be seen as distancing myself from my communist allies. Although I could have been sent back to jail for voicing such views, I did not hesitate to reaffirm the tremendous support the communists had given us. At one point, the bench posed the question as to whether or not I thought a one-party state was a viable option for South Africa. "My lord, it is not a question of form. It is a question of democracy. If democracy would best be expressed by a one-party system, then I would examine the proposition very carefully. But if a democracy could best be expressed by a multi-party system, then I would examine that carefully. In this country, for example, we have a multi-party system at present. But so far as the non-Europeans are concerned, this is the most vicious despotism that you could think of." I became testy with Judge Rumpf when he fell into the same mistake made by so many white South Africans about the idea of a universal franchise. Their notion was that to exercise this responsibility, voters must be educated. To a narrow-thinking person, it is hard to explain that to be educated does not only mean being literate and having a BA, and that an illiterate man can be a far more educated voter than someone with an advanced degree. Justice Rampf, what is the value of participation in the government of a state of people who know nothing? Mandela, my lord, what happens when illiterate whites vote? Justice Rampf, are they not subject as much to the influence of election leaders as children would be? Mandela, no, my lord. This is what happens in practice. A man stands up to contest a seat in a particular area. He draws up a manifesto, and he says, these are the ideas for which I stand. It is a rural area, and he says, I am against stock limitation. Then, listening to the policy of this person, you decide whether this man will advance your interests if you return him to Parliament, and on that basis, you vote for a candidate. It has nothing to do with education. Justice Rampf, he only looks to his own interests? Mandela, no, a man looks at a man who will be able to best present his point of view and votes for that man. I told the court that we believed we could achieve our demands without violence, through our numerical superiority. We had in mind that in the foreseeable future, it will be possible for us to achieve these demands, and we worked on the basis that Europeans themselves, in spite of the wall of prejudice and hostility which we encountered, that they can never remain indifferent indefinitely to our demands, because we are hitting them in the stomach with our policy of economic pressure. The Europeans dare not look at it with indifference. They would have to respond to it, and indeed, my lord, they are responding to it. The emergency was lifted on the last day of August. We would be going home for the first time in 5 months. When people in Johannesburg heard about the end of the emergency, they drove up on the chance that we might be released. When we were let go, we were met with a jubilant reception from friends and family. Winnie had gotten a ride to Pretoria, and our reunion was joyous. I had not held my wife in 5 months, or seen her smile with joy. For the first time in 5 months, I slept in my own bed that night. After one has been in prison, it is the small things that one appreciates. Being able to take a walk whenever one wants. Going into a shop and buying a newspaper. Speaking or choosing to remain silent. The simple act of being able to control one's person. Even after the end of the emergency, the trial continued for another 9 months until March 29, 1961. In many ways, these were the glory days for the accused, for our own people were on the stand fearlessly enunciating ANC policy. Robert Rescher forcefully disputed the government's absurd contention that the ANC wanted to induce the government to use violence so we could use violence in return. Gert Sibandi eloquently told the court of the miseries of African farm workers. Venerable Isaac Bendy of Ladysmith, 81 years old, a lay preacher of the African Native Mission Church, explained why we opted for stay-at-homes instead of strikes. In October, the redoubtable Professor Matthews was called as our final witness. He was imperturbable on the witness stand and treated the prosecutors as though they were errant students who needed stern admonishment. Often he would reply to the overmastered prosecutor with some version of the following. What you really want me to say is that the speech which you allege is violent represents the policy of my organization. First, your contention is incorrect, and second, I am not going to say that. He explained in beautiful language that the African people knew that a non-violent struggle would entail suffering, but had chosen it because they prized freedom above all else. People, he said, will willingly undergo the severest suffering in order to free themselves from oppression. With Professor Matthews in the dock, the defense ended on a high note. After he finished testifying, Justice Kennedy shook his hand and expressed the hope that they would meet again under better circumstances. Chapter 37. After the lifting of the emergency, the National Executive Committee met secretly in September to discuss the future. We had had discussions in jail during the trial, but this was our first formal session. The state was arming itself not for an external threat, but an internal one. We would not disband, but carry on from underground. We would have to depart from the democratic procedures outlined in the ANC's constitution of holding conferences, branch meetings, and public gatherings. New structures had to be created for communication with unbanned Congress organizations. But all of these new structures were illegal and would subject the participants to arrest and imprisonment. The executive committee and its subordinate structures would have to be severely streamlined to adapt to illegal conditions. Of necessity, we dissolved the ANC Youth League and Women's League. Some fiercely resisted these changes, but the fact was that we were now an illegal organization. For those who would continue to participate, politics went from being a risky occupation to a truly perilous one. Though Mandela and Tambo had closed its doors and settled its remaining accounts, I continued to do whatever legal work I could. Numerous colleagues readily made their offices, staff, and phone facilities available to me, but most of the time I preferred to work from Ahmed Kathrada's flat, number 13 Colvard House. Although my practice had dissolved, my reputation as a lawyer was undimmed. Soon, the lounge of number 13 and the hallway outside were crammed with clients. Kathy would return home and discover to his dismay that the only room in which he could be alone was his kitchen. During this period, I hardly had time for meals and saw very little of my family. I would stay late in Pretoria preparing for our case or rush back to handle another case. When I could actually sit down to supper with my family, the telephone would ring and I would be called away. Winnie was pregnant again and infinitely patient. She was hoping her husband might actually be at the hospital when she gave birth. But it was not to be. During the Christmas adjournment in 1960, I learned that Makato was ill in the Transkei where he was at school, and I violated my banning orders and went down to see him. I drove the entire night, stopping only for petrol. Makato required surgery, and I decided to bring him back with me to Johannesburg. I again drove all night and took Makato to his mother's place while I went to arrange for his surgery. When I returned, I learned that Winnie had already gone into labor. I rushed to the non-European wing of Bridgman Memorial Hospital to find that mother and daughter were already in residence. The newborn girl was fine, but Winnie was very weak. We named our new daughter Zinziswa, after the daughter of the poet laureate of the Xhosa people, Samuel Nkayi, who had inspired me so many years before at Healdtown. The poet returned home after a very long trip to find that his wife had given birth to a daughter. He had not known that she was pregnant and assumed that the child had been fathered by another man. In our culture, when a woman gives birth, the husband does not enter the house where she is confined for 10 days. In this case, the poet was too enraged to observe this custom, and he stormed into the house with an assegai, ready to stab both mother and daughter. But when he looked at the baby girl and saw that she was the image of himself, he stepped back and said, "U Zinzile," which means, "You are well established." He named her Zinziswa, the feminine version of what he had said. Chapter 38. The Crown took over a month to do its summing up, which was often interrupted by interjections from the bench pointing out lapses in the argument. In March, it was our turn. Izzy Maisels categorically refuted the charges of violence. "We admit that there is a question of non-cooperation and passive resistance," he said. "We will say, quite frankly, that if non-cooperation and passive resistance constitute high treason, then we are guilty. But these are plainly not encompassed in the law of treason." Maisel's argument was continued by Bram Fischer, but on March 23rd, the bench cut short Bram's concluding argument. We still had weeks of argument ahead, but the judges asked for a week's adjournment. This was irregular, but we regarded it as a hopeful sign, for it suggested the judges had already formed their opinion. We were to return to court 6 days later for what we presumed would be the verdict. In the meantime, I had work to do. My bans were due to expire 2 days after the adjournment. I was almost certain that the police would not be aware of this, as they rarely kept track of when bans ended. It would be the first time in nearly 5 years that I would be free to leave Johannesburg, free to attend a meeting. That weekend was the long-planned all-in conference in Pietermaritzburg. Its aim was to agitate for a national constitutional convention for all South Africans. I was secretly scheduled to be the main speaker at the conference. I would make the 300-mile drive down to Pietermaritzburg the night before I was scheduled to speak. The day before I was to leave, the National Working Committee met secretly to discuss strategy. After many meetings in prison and outside, we had decided that we would work from underground, adopting a strategy along the lines of the M Plan. The organization would survive clandestinely. It was decided that if we were not convicted, I would go underground to travel about the country, organizing the proposed national convention. Only someone operating full-time from underground would be free from the paralyzing restrictions imposed by the enemy. It was decided that I would surface at certain events, hoping for a maximum of publicity, to show that the ANC was still fighting. It was not a proposal that came as a surprise to me, nor was it one I particularly relished, but it was something I knew I had to do. This would be a hazardous life, and I would be apart from my family. But when a man is denied the right to live the life he believes in, he has no choice but to become an outlaw. When I returned home from the meeting, it was as if Winnie could read my thoughts. Seeing my face, she knew that I was about to embark on a life that neither of us wanted. I explained what had transpired, and that I would be leaving the next day. She took this stoically, as if she had expected it all along. She understood what I had to do, but that did not make it any easier for her. I asked her to pack a small suitcase for me. I told her that friends and relatives would look after her while I was gone. I did not tell her how long I would be gone, and she did not ask. It was just as well, because I did not know the answer. I would return to Pretoria for what would probably be the verdict on Monday. No matter the result, I would not be returning home. If we were convicted, I would go directly to prison. If we were discharged, I would immediately go underground. My elder son, Tembi, was in school in the Transkei, so I could not say goodbye to him. But that afternoon, I fetched Makatu and my daughter Makaziwe from their mother in Orlando East. We spent some hours together, walking on the veld outside town, talking and playing. I said goodbye to them, not knowing when I would see them again. The children of a freedom fighter also learn not to ask their father too many questions, and I could see in their eyes that they understood that something serious was occurring. At home, I kissed the two girls goodbye, and they waved as I got in the car with Wilson Konko and began the long drive to Natal. 1,400 delegates from all over the country, representing 150 different religious, social, cultural, and political bodies, converged on Pietermaritzburg for the All-In Conference. When I walked out on stage on Saturday evening, March 25th, in front of this loyal and enthusiastic audience, it had been nearly 5 years since I had been free to give a speech on a public platform. I was met with a joyous reaction. I had almost forgotten the intensity of the experience of addressing a crowd. In my speech, I called for a national convention in which all South Africans, black and white, Indian and colored, would sit down in brotherhood and create a constitution that mirrored the aspirations of the country as a whole. I called for unity and said we would be invincible if we spoke with one voice. The All-In Conference called for a national convention of elected representatives of all adult men and women, on an equal basis, to determine a new, non-racial, democratic constitution for South Africa. A National Action Council was elected, with myself as honorary secretary, to communicate this demand to the government. If the government failed to call such a convention, we would call a countrywide 3-day stay-away beginning on May 29th, to coincide with the declaration of South Africa as a republic. I had no illusions that the state would agree to our proposal. In October 1960, the government had held an all-white referendum on whether South Africa should become a republic. This was one of the long-cherished dreams of Afrikaner nationalism, to cast off ties to the country they had fought against in the Anglo-Boer War. The pro-republic sentiment won with 52% of the vote, and the proclamation of the republic was set for May 31st, 1961. We set our stay at home on the date of the proclamation to indicate that such a change for us was merely cosmetic. Directly after the conference, I sent Prime Minister Verwoerd a letter in which I formally enjoined him to call a national constitutional convention. I warned him that if he failed to call the convention, we would stage the country's most massive 3-day strike ever, beginning on May 29th. "We have no illusions about the countermeasures your government might take," I wrote. "During the last 12 months, we have gone through a period of grim dictatorship." I also issued press statements affirming that the strike was a peaceful and non-violent stay-at-home. Verwoerd did not reply, except to describe my letter in Parliament as arrogant. The government instead began to mount one of the most intimidating displays of force ever assembled in the country's history. Chapter 39. Even before the doors of the old synagogue opened on the morning of March 29, 1961, the day of the long-anticipated verdict in the treason trial, a crowd of supporters and press people jostled to get inside. Hundreds were turned away. When the judges brought the court to order, the visitors' gallery and the press bench were packed. Moments after Justice Rumpf pounded his gavel, the Crown made an extraordinary application to change the indictment. This was the 59th minute of the 11th hour, and it was 2 years too late. The court rebuffed the prosecution, and the gallery murmured its approval. "Silence in the court," the orderly yelled, and Judge Rumpf announced that the 3-judge panel had reached a verdict. Silence now reigned. In his deep, even voice, Judge Rumpf reviewed the court's conclusions. Yes, the African National Congress had been working to replace the government with a radically and fundamentally different form of state. Yes, the African National Congress had used illegal means of protest during the defiance campaign. Yes, certain ANC leaders had made speeches advocating violence, and yes, there was a strong left-wing tendency in the ANC that was revealed in its anti-imperialist, anti-West, pro-Soviet attitudes. But, on all the evidence presented to this court, and on our finding of fact, it is impossible for this court to come to the conclusion that the African National Congress had acquired or adopted a policy to overthrow the state by violence. That is, in the sense that the masses had to be prepared or conditioned to commit direct acts of violence against the state. The court said the prosecution had failed to prove that the ANC was a communist organization or that the Freedom Charter envisioned a communist state. After speaking for 40 minutes, Justice Rumpf said, "The accused are accordingly found not guilty and are discharged." The spectators' gallery erupted in cheers. We stood and hugged each other and waved to the happy courtroom. All of us then paraded into the courtyard, smiling, laughing, crying. The crowd yelled and chanted as we emerged. A number of us hoisted our defense counsels on our shoulders, which was no easy task in the case of Izzy Mazels, for he was such a large man. Flash bulbs were popping all around us. We looked around for friends, wives, relatives. Winnie had come up and I hugged her in joy, though I knew that while I might be free for this moment, I would not be able to savor that freedom. After more than 4 years in court and dozens of prosecutors, thousands of documents and tens of thousands of pages of testimony, the state had failed in its mission. The verdict was an embarrassment to the government, both at home and abroad. Yet the result only embittered the state against us even further. The lesson they took away was not that we had legitimate grievances, but that they needed to be far more ruthless. I did not regard the verdict as a vindication of the legal system or evidence that a black man could get a fair trial in a white man's court. It was the right verdict and a just one, but it was largely as a result of a superior defense team and the fair-mindedness of the panel of these particular judges. The court system, however, was perhaps the only place in South Africa where an African could possibly receive a fair hearing and where the rule of law might still apply. This was particularly true in courts presided over by enlightened judges who had been appointed by the United Party. Many of these men still stood by the rule of law. As a student, I had been taught that South Africa was a place where the rule of law was paramount and applied to all persons regardless of their social status or official position. I sincerely believed this and planned my life based on that assumption. But my career as a lawyer and activist removed the scales from my eyes. I saw that there was a wide difference between what I had been taught in the lecture room and what I learned in the courtroom. I went from having an idealistic view of the law as a sword of justice to a perception of the law as a tool used by the ruling class to shape society in a way favorable to itself. I never expected justice in court, however much I fought for it, and though I sometimes received it. In the case of the treason trial, the three judges rose above their prejudices, their education, and their background. There is a streak of goodness in men that can be buried or hidden and then emerge unexpectedly. Justice Rumpf, with his aloof manner, gave the impression throughout the proceedings that he shared the point of view of the ruling white minority. Yet in the end, an essential fairness dominated his judgment. Kennedy was less conservative than his colleagues and seemed attracted by the idea of equality. Once, for example, he and Duma Nokwe flew on the same plane from Durban to Johannesburg, and when the airline bus to town refused to take Duma, Kennedy refused to ride in it as well. Judge Becker always struck me as open-minded and seemed aware that the accused before him had suffered a great deal at the hands of the state. I commended these three men as individuals, not as representatives of the court or of the state or even of their race, but as exemplars of human decency under adversity. Judge Becker's wife was a person sensitive to the needs of others. During the state of emergency, she collected goods which she brought to the accused. But the consequence of the government's humiliating defeat was that the state decided never to let it happen again. From that day forth, they were not going to rely on judges whom they had not themselves appointed. They were not going to observe what they considered the legal niceties that protected terrorists or permitted convicted prisoners certain rights in jail. During the treason trial, there were no examples of individuals being isolated, beaten, and tortured in order to elicit information. All of those things became commonplace shortly thereafter. Part 6. The Black Pimpernel. Chapter 40. I did not return home after the verdict. Although others were in a festive mood and eager to celebrate, I knew the authorities could strike at any moment, and I did not want to give them the opportunity. I was anxious to be off before I was banned or arrested, and I spent the night in a safe house in Johannesburg. It was a restless night in a strange bed, and I started at the sound of every car, thinking it might be the police. Walter and Duma saw me off on the first leg of my journey, which was to take me to Port Elizabeth. In P.E., I met with Govan Mbeki and Raymond Mhlaba to discuss the new underground structures of the organization. We met at the house of Dr. Masla Patha, who would later be sentenced to 2 years in prison for allowing us to meet at his home. At safe houses arranged by the organization, I met the editor of the liberal Port Elizabeth Evening Post to discuss the campaign for a national convention, a goal several newspapers subsequently endorsed. I later visited Patrick Duncan, the editor and publisher of the liberal weekly Contact, a founding member of the Liberal Party and one of the first white defiers during the Defiance campaign. His newspaper had repeatedly been decrying ANC policy as being dictated by communists, but when he saw me, the first thing he said was that a close reading of the treason trial record had disabused him of that notion, and he would correct it in his paper. That night, I addressed a meeting of African township ministers in Cape Town. I mention this because the opening prayer of one of the ministers has stayed with me over these many years and was a source of strength at a difficult time. He thanked the Lord for his bounty and goodness, for his mercy, and his concern for all men. But then he took the liberty of reminding the Lord that some of his subjects were more downtrodden than others, and that it sometimes seemed as though he was not paying attention. The minister then said that if the Lord did not show a little more initiative in leading the black man to salvation, the black man would have to take matters into his own two hands. Amen. On my last morning in Cape Town, I was leaving my hotel in the company of George Peake, a founding member of the South African Colored People's Organization, and I stopped to thank the colored manager of the hotel for looking after me so well. He was grateful, but also curious. He had discovered my identity and told me that the colored community feared that under an African government, they would be just as oppressed as under the present white government. He was a middle-class businessman who probably had little contact with Africans and feared them in the same way as whites did. This was a frequent anxiety on the part of the colored community, especially in the Cape, and though I was running late, I explained the Freedom Charter to this fellow and stressed our commitment to non-racialism. A freedom fighter must take every opportunity to make his case to the people. The following day, I joined a secret meeting of the ANC National Executive Committee and the joint executives of the Congress movement in Durban to discuss whether the planned action should take the form of a stay-at-home or a full-fledged strike with organized pickets and demonstrations. Those who argued for the strike said that the stay-at-home strategy we had used since 1950 had outlasted its usefulness, that at a time when the PAC was appealing to the masses, more militant forms of the struggle were necessary. The alternative view, which I advocated, was that stay-at-homes allowed us to strike at the enemy while preventing him from striking back. I argued that the confidence of the people in our campaigns had grown precisely because they realized that we were not reckless with their lives. Sharpeville, I said, for all the heroism of the demonstrators, allowed the enemy to shoot down our people. I argued for stay-at-homes, even though I was aware that our people around the country were becoming impatient with passive forms of struggle, but I did not think we should depart from our proven tactics without comprehensive planning, and we had neither the time nor the resources to do so. The decision was for a stay-at-home. Living underground requires a seismic psychological shift. One has to plan every action, however small and seemingly insignificant. Nothing is innocent. Everything is questioned. You cannot be yourself. You must fully inhabit whatever role you have assumed. In some ways, this is not much of an adaptation for a black man in South Africa. Under apartheid, a black man lived a shadowy life between legality and illegality, between openness and concealment. To be a black man in South Africa meant not to trust anything, which was not unlike living underground for one's entire life. I became a creature of the night. I would keep to my hideout during the day and would emerge to do my work when it became dark. I operated mainly from Johannesburg, but I would travel as necessary. I stayed in empty flats, in people's houses, wherever I could be alone and inconspicuous. Although I am a gregarious person, I love solitude even more. I welcomed the opportunity to be by myself, to plan, to think, to plot. But one can have too much of solitude. I was terribly lonesome for my wife and family. The key to being underground is to be invisible. Just as there is a way to walk in a room in order to make yourself stand out, there is a way of walking and behaving that makes you inconspicuous. As a leader, one often seeks prominence. As an outlaw, the opposite is true. When underground, I did not walk as tall or stand as straight. I spoke more softly, with less clarity and distinction. I was more passive, more unobtrusive. I did not ask for things, but instead let people tell me what to do. I did not shave or cut my hair. My most frequent disguise was as a chauffeur, a chef, or a garden boy. I would wear the blue overalls of the field worker and often wore round, rimless glasses known as Maserati tea glasses. I had a car, and I wore a chauffeur's cap with my overalls. The pose of chauffeur was convenient because I could travel under the pretext of driving my master's car. During those early months, when there was a warrant for my arrest and I was being pursued by the police, my outlaw existence caught the imagination of the press. Articles claiming that I had been here and there were on the front pages. Roadblocks were instituted all over the country. But the police repeatedly came up empty-handed. I was dubbed the Black Pimpernel, a somewhat derogatory adaptation of Baroness Orksey's fictional character, the Scarlet Pimpernel, who daringly evaded capture during the French Revolution. I traveled secretly about the country. I was with Muslims in the Cape, with sugar workers in Natal, with factory workers in Port Elizabeth. I moved through townships in different parts of the country, attending secret meetings at night. I would even feed the mythology of the Black Pimpernel by taking a pocketful of tickies, 23-penny pieces, and phoning individual newspaper reporters from telephone boxes and replaying to them stories of what we were planning or of the ineptitude of the police. I would pop up here and there to the annoyance of the police and to the delight of the people. There were many wild and inaccurate stories about my experiences underground. People love to embellish tales of daring. I did have a number of narrow escapes, however, which no one knew about. On one occasion, I was driving in town, and I stopped at a traffic light. I looked to my left, and in an adjacent car saw Colonel Spengler, the chief of the Witwatersrand security branch. It would have been a great plum for him to catch the Black Pimpernel. I was wearing a workman's cap, my blue overalls, and my glasses. He never looked my way. But even so, the seconds I spent waiting for the light to change seemed like hours. One afternoon, when I was in Johannesburg, posing as a chauffeur and wearing my long duster and cap, I was waiting on a corner to be picked up, and I saw an African policeman striding deliberately toward me. I looked around to see if I had a place to run, but before I did, he smiled at me and surreptitiously gave me the thumbs-up ANC salute and was gone. Incidents like this happened many times, and I was reassured when I saw that we had the loyalty of many African policemen. There was a black sergeant who used to tip off Winnie as to what the police were doing. He would whisper to her, "Make sure Madiba is not in Alexandra on Wednesday night because there is going to be a raid." Black policemen have often been severely criticized during the struggle, but many have played covert roles that have been extremely valuable. When I was underground, I remained as unkempt as possible. My overalls looked as if they had been through a lifetime of hard toil. The police had one picture of me with a beard, which they widely distributed, and my colleagues urged me to shave it off. But I had become attached to my beard, and I resisted all efforts to get me to shave. Not only was I not recognized, I was sometimes snubbed. Once, I was planning to attend a meeting in a distant area of Johannesburg, and a well-known priest arranged with friends of his to put me up for the night. I arrived at the door, and before I could announce who I was, the elderly lady who answered exclaimed, "No, we don't want such a man as you here," and shut the door. Chapter 41. My time underground was mainly taken up in planning the May 29th stay-at-home. It was shaping up to be a virtual war between the state and the liberation movement. Late in May, the government staged countrywide raids on opposition leaders. Meetings were banned, printing presses were seized, and legislation was rushed through Parliament permitting the police to detain charged prisoners for 12 days without bail. Verwoerd declared that those supporting the strike, including sympathetic newspapers, were playing with fire, an ominous declaration given the ruthlessness of the state. The government urged industries to provide sleeping accommodations for workers so that they would not have to return home during the strike. 2 days before the stay-at-home, the government staged the greatest peacetime show of force in South African history. The military exercised its largest call-up since the war. Police holidays were cancelled. Military units were stationed at the entrances and exits of townships. While Saracen tanks rumbled through the dirt streets of the townships, helicopters hovered above, swooping down to break up any gathering. At night, the helicopters trained searchlights on houses. The English-language press had widely publicized the campaign until a few days before it was to begin. But on the eve of the stay-at-home, the entire English-language press crumbled and urged people to go to work. The PAC played the role of saboteur and released thousands of flyers telling people to oppose the stay-at-home and denouncing the ANC leaders as cowards. The PAC's actions shocked us. It is one thing to criticize, and that we can accept, but to attempt to break a strike by calling upon the people to go to work directly serves the interests of the enemy. The night before the stay-at-home, I was scheduled to meet the Johannesburg leadership of the ANC at a safe house in Soweto. To avoid police roadblocks, I entered Soweto through Cliptown, which was normally not patrolled. But as I went around a blind corner, I drove straight into what I had been trying to avoid, a roadblock. A white policeman motioned for me to stop. I was dressed in my usual costume of overalls and chauffeur's cap. He squinted through the window at me and then stepped forward and searched the car on his own. Normally, this was the duty of the African police. After he found nothing, he demanded my pass. I told him that I had left it at home by mistake and casually recited a fictitious pass number. This seemed to satisfy him, and he motioned for me to drive through. On Monday, May 29th, the first day of the stay-at-home, hundreds of thousands of people risk their jobs and livelihoods by not going to work. In Durban, Indian workers walked out of factories, while in the Cape, thousands of colored workers stayed home. In Johannesburg, more than half of employees stayed home, and in Port Elizabeth, the rate was even higher. I praised the response as magnificent to the press, lauding our people for defying unprecedented intimidation by the state. The white celebration of Republic Day was drowned out by our protest. Although reports on the first day of the stay-at-home suggested strong reactions in various parts of the country, the response as a whole appeared less than we had hoped. Communication was difficult, and bad news always seems to travel more efficiently than good news. As more reports came in, I felt let down and disappointed by the reaction. That evening, feeling demoralized and a bit angry, I had a conversation with Benjamin Pogrund of the Rand Daily Mail, in which I suggested that the days of non-violent struggle were over. On the second day of the stay-at-home, after consultations with my colleagues, I called it off. I met that morning in a safe flat in a white suburb with various members of the local and foreign press, and I once again called the stay-at-home a tremendous success. But I did not